Well, folks, we're going to get started today. So I'm going to call the meeting to order of the Statewide Cable Franchising Working Group and begin the process for today. What we're going to do is I'm going to just say a few welcoming comments and take a look at our agenda here, make sure we're all on the same page of where we're going to be going. And talk a little bit what we're going to go over the next few weeks as we continue to work on this issue of statewide cable franchising. Today it is going to be Peg. We got our top-notch researcher here, Bob Ulis, is going to give us kind of a rundown on some of the issues, give an opportunity for folks to weigh in with their thoughts and opinions with respect to Peg. And again, the whole notion of the working group isn't to answer, resolve, or solve the problems that are before us here at this particular meeting, but rather to get the ideas and notions and important details out there so we can give it some thought and consideration and as we work on it, use those ideas and details to come up with a solution that's going to be a positive plus for the bill that's being put together. Now, we last met on December 9th and looked at franchise fees, or November 9th, and looked at franchise fees and INET and gross revenue definitions. And John and I have received position papers and so forth on that. That's been very helpful. But before we get into that, let me just restate, just so we're clear, for all here, what the reasons for offering this bill are in the first place. And I'm just going to lay out what those are for folks again so they understand the reason we're moving this bill forward. Now, the first major reason, of course, is competition. And I'm a strong believer that we need more competition in the cable TV industry and all the benefits that are going to bring to the consumers and all the pluses from this extra competition that we can make in this whole industry. The second aspect is the speeding up of the deployment of broadband throughout the state. So those two things together, I think, provide a good impetus for taking a look at a bill that's going to work in that regard, competition and speeding up the deployment of broadband. A second related opinion that I think is also important is that Chapter 238 needs to be reworked. I think, it's, in my opinion, it's clearly outdated. Needs to be revised to reflect the current reality of the digital age. I think it was put together back in the late 70s and 80s, pre-internet. And now we have telephone companies and cable companies that operate integrated broadband networks capable of providing voice, video, and data, and that's certainly wasn't the case when that chapter was put together. So I think the timing is right from a couple of perspectives, competition, deployment of broadband, reworking Chapter 238 so it reflects the reality of the digital age we live in. I think the timing is right to move forward. And as challenging a task as this might be, I think the need is there, and I think we need to do some reflection and some thinking and some work together to get out the details and nuances that are going to make this bill a very positive thing for the state of Minnesota. I'm not interested in, I have no close connections with the cable companies or with the telephone companies. What I am interested in, though, is the consumer and good public policy that's going to serve the needs of the state, and I think the timing is right to make some changes in the current system to see that happen. Now, we've had one working group essentially meet last Friday, December 7th, with, I think, some mixed results. I heard some feedback both ways on how that particular group went. But I think we're going to find as we continue meeting and discussing these issues, we're going to argue and find some areas of agreement, some areas of disagreement. But I think we still need to keep working together on this very complex and very nuanced issue. I think there's some certain principles that we need to keep in mind, and those are the ones that I stated prior. I know it is frustrating, but I still think it is an important thing we need to do. I found the position papers in particular to be especially helpful, and I think we've passed them around so everyone's had an opportunity to review them. We'll do a similar thing with the discussion on PEG today. The expectation after the meeting is that folks will submit their PEG position papers, essentially, on what their thoughts are in that regard once you've had a chance to review it. And we'll also make sure that gets sent out to everyone here who is of interest, who has an interest in it. I'm not expecting or laying out like I did last time stakeholder meetings in the in-between. If folks want to get together and talk, I guess that's between you know, you and whoever you want to meet with. But we're not going to set up any rooms to go ahead and meet forward like that. But I did find the position papers particularly helpful, and we'll be, as I said, expecting those and circulating those for your own use. So that's kind of a little bit of the roadmap that lays before us. We're going to take a look at the PEG today. We're going to keep looking at the position papers that we have on the other issues that are before us as we look at putting together a bill. And a little ways down the line, we're going to be looking at build-out and looking at what some of the models, some paradigms, some things our folks have done that might make sense for the state of Minnesota. And with that, if anyone has any brief comments additionally, we can certainly take them. I want to welcome the gentleman we have here sitting in for, I think, Ann Higgins. Yes. Do you want to introduce yourself so people know who you are?
Sure. Tom Grundhofer, and the General Counsel of the League of Cities.
And welcome.
Thank you.
And I see Ron's here. I don't think he was here last time. Introduce yourself so everyone knows who you are.
Ron Elwood with Legal Aid.
Juanita.
Juanita Brown with AT&T.
And I think everyone else, other than Representative Junkie and Representative Hilty, are also here additionally. Yeah. Oh, and Representative Mason over here. Kind of stuck in you, I didn't see you say about that. So, with that, we're going to move into the issues surrounding PEG. We're going to give the opportunity for Mr. Elif to give an overview of it, so we have some framework on which to talk about the issue, and again to get some details out there. The point again is not to solve any PEG issues today, but again to talk about what it is that's important from your perspective perhaps, or that needs to get out there so they can all take an honest look at it. So Bob, why don't I turn over to you at this point and
thank you.
Go with it.
This will be short. I just wanted to refer to the handouts that I think are in all of your packets that I prepared for today's meeting. One is a three-page table that looks at how these two issues were handled in each of the 17 states that have passed statewide franchising bills in the last couple of years. I think as we consider various options, it's a good idea to know at least what other states have passed. And now that there are 17 states, the first year I did this there were only 8, even this is a little bit complicated, so I prepared kind of a one-page cheat sheet as a guide, because the changes in the various states really do fall into just a few different kinds of categories. And looking at the table at the top of that sheet with respect to PEG channels, some states just pick an absolute number of PEG channels that are required of new state video franchise operators, up to 2 in the case of Kansas, 2 in the case of New Jersey. 5 states just say same number as incumbent. Then there's some variations on that. Same as the incumbent, but depending on population, that sets a limit. Or at least the same number as the incumbent, basically letting negotiations occur for folks who may want more. And finally, there are, maybe surprisingly, only 2 states talk about the number of PEG channels that must be provided if there is no incumbent. Essentially, the rest of them just don't address that question. And on the table at the bottom regarding PEG support fees, I think there are even fewer variations on the theme. 5 states at the top require no PEG support from new state video franchises. And I think there are 9 states that require maintaining the current level of support either through a given date that's actually in the legislation or through the expiration date of whatever local franchise is relevant. And finally, again, there are four states that actually talk about PEG support past that incumbent expiration date and on into the future. Again, the rest of the states just don't address that question. So these are just kind of some of the ways that other states have dealt with some of the issues that, that we'll be facing here as well. And if anybody needs additional information on how specific states do this, I'd be happy to provide that.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Jeff?
Representative Johnson, I just if I can just ask you a question. When they talk about three, up to three channels or less than three channels, are they talking about each municipality?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the floor is basically open. I know I talked with Mike earlier. I know that's a very important issue for you, Mike. I don't know if you want to take the floor and say a few things about where you're coming from and what's important. That might be a useful piece of information.
Well, thank you, Representative Johnson. I think one of the things that makes Minnesota unique is that because of 238's flexibility, local municipalities and community members have been able to negotiate different types of PEG requirements depending upon the community need. I think it's safe to say that the need in St. Paul or Minneapolis was very, very, you know, dense urban infrastructure, varieties of different languages spoken, a whole host of different educational needs is different from, say, the needs within a community of 4,000 people in western Minnesota. And I think that's one of the virtues of the current system that we have right now. It's hard to try to, from my perspective, it's hard to try to put a one-size-fits-all solution, because I know that the system that we have in St. Paul won't work for a much smaller community, for example. They may actually see it as excessive, but certainly in terms of the community we've got in St. Paul, you know, the system works in terms of the PEG support that's provided as well as the channel capacity. In our instance, there are seven channels, including, significantly, something that's not in any of these state instances, the Metro Channel 6 interconnect channel, which is a requirement of all franchises within the metropolitan area. Maybe someone can correct me specifically for what those counties are. It's unclear to me what happens with Metro Channel 6 under this type of scheme. Yeah. That seems to me to be a significant thing within the Minnesota context that is just not within other legislative discussion. PEG support, if you want to kind of look at, you know, your overview for support fees versus channel requirements, PEG support varies across the state depending upon those local needs. Just to kind of describe where different communities are. In smaller communities, in greater Minnesota, the likelihood is that PEG is supported by a portion of the franchise fee, and that there was no negotiated extra support fee. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, there are 20 PEG operations representing 70 communities. The majority of them have some type of PEG support fee that has been negotiated, with one or two significant exceptions, where that operation is supported by the franchise fee. I can speak to the metro area specifically, having state-mandated level of support would probably drastically affect PEG operations throughout the Twin Cities. I can speak from my context in St. Paul. We did an analysis of this when the federal legislation was being discussed in 2005 and 2006 in terms of effects in North Metro for Roseville and the 15 communities that they represent, and with CTV 15. Same thing is true with White Bear Lake and Northeast Metro. You'd see significant reduction of service levels, or alternatively, a greater burden put on the cities. Cities are forced to figure out if they pay for that service out of their budget or not. And that's actually also what you're seeing around the country with these types of bills. I don't know if you want me to kind of go into some greater detail with other sort of some technical deficiencies that are in other state bills or not. Really, I was thinking more along the lines of trying to describe the reality of the situation within the state of Minnesota first.
I guess what I'd like to hear from you, Mike, is what would you like to see in the bill that would meet the needs of PEG? I mean, that's kind of where we're heading. How do we make the bill work in a way that PEG works?
Well, I mean, PEG works. PEG works because local franchising typically works. So local enforcement of regulation is extremely important for local franchising. I mean, it would be impossible for a smaller community to go up to the state of Minnesota to be able to get redress if something was not working appropriately. I think it would be beyond the realm of the reach of a lot of smaller communities. You know, as I look at the other state franchises that are being rolled out right now that Bob described here, the effects on PEG are radically bad. And the only, you know, so for example, you know, in Michigan, there are 9 large communities that will probably be seeing their PEG services wink out. And these are not small communities, it's like communities like Flint, Michigan, and Detroit, you know, the communities people have heard about, right, because of the way in which the bill has been crafted. Same thing's true in Texas, you know, with like San Antonio, losing their services because of the way in which SB 5 was drafted. And it's no one's guilty of anything here. It's just something that I think companies take advantage of when the law is crafted in a certain way. So I think when you look at Bob's chart here, the only I think community interest victories that I've seen have been in Illinois. Actually, I think Illinois is probably the exception to the rule in terms of the ability to have local franchises respected, having the community benefits that local communities have negotiated and fought for respected or continue. So as I look at state franchising from the PEG perspective, or these types of franchising laws from the PEG perspective, I don't see anything good for communities, typically. And I think Illinois is the one exception to that in terms of being able to preserve the rights and benefits and the local enforcement that help ensure that PEG flourishes in local communities. I hope that helped a little bit to kind of give you a...
Well, it helps a little bit, but again, I want you to try to think a little bit outside the box about what it is that works for PEG. I know what some of the other states have done. I reviewed that, and we've discussed that individually.
Well, I mean,
I'm aware of all that. What I want you to do is to think about what it is that can make the bill work for PEG, and if it's the Illinois bill, well, then I would like you to think about what it is in that bill that's going to make the bill work.
If I can, you know, the things that work for PEG... And these are like characteristics of a what I would describe as a strong franchise. Are things like ensuring that the channel quality of PEG channels has an equal quality as the channel quality of commercial channels, for example. That's a provision that's in many local franchises. That is extremely important to ensure that the quality of transmission is not reduced by a corporation. Who pays for transmission of the channel to the consumer? In almost all instances, it's not up to the PEG entity to put pay for transmission. It's up to the video service provider, the cable company, to pay for that transmission. That's currently a standard, you know, that is negotiated at the local level in a franchise. And I think it's important that's a value that not be not be gone back on, because that could actually harm communities, it seems to me. Channel location, navigation, and number are all issues that are put into sound local franchises. Okay? And those are issues that have been problematic with a number of these bills across the country. And I think significantly, I think the most significant thing is the need for local communities to be able to react to the needs of a changing environment. And I think that's extremely important. As I mentioned in testimony last spring here, it's hard to imagine what the technical needs of our citizens are going to be in the next 10 years, let alone in perpetuity. Local franchising actually gives you the ability to adjust those PEG needs for the local conditions as they change. And I think that's an extremely important value. If we want to have state law be responsive to community needs. Okay, we want to get back to this question of value and need. For going to give you a concrete example here. As the need for caption services increases in the state of Minnesota, I think most observers predict that if you talk to like the State Commission of Hard of Hearing and Deaf Minnesotans, they predict that there will be an increase in need for assistive technology, because the number of people who have hearing disorders will be increasing in coming years with an aging population. Having the ability to negotiate with cable systems to ensure that those types of captioning systems can be relayed to consumers is important. Same thing's also true with like EAS requirements. And that's kind of the level of detail that you get into with that kind of...
Well, that's the kind of detail I think the stakeholders need to hear as we work on the bill. So that's why I'm asking to present some concrete things that could be included that are going to make the bill work. I'd be curious, do you think, what could a statewide franchising bill do to increase PEG out in, out in the rural area? Have you ever given that any thought?
I think that's an interesting question, and I don't know what the best mechanism to do that would be. I think there's an argument for smaller communities that may be seeing growth, or maybe seeing, in some cases, explosive growth. You look like the edge of the metro area, that they may have more educational need for service, or they may have changing population. Having an ability to meet that need as the population changes is going to be important. So I think there's that aspect. Having the ability for the state to support the creation of community media centers that have the ability to meet those needs in some way is something that 238 doesn't address, and that none of the state video franchising laws actually address, but it's actually something that's more closer to my organization's heart. It's not necessarily something that, you know, my counterparts would support necessarily, I think. But I definitely see a need for the ability for local franchising, or at least local communities, to be able to demand educational services in some instances. Some communities right now are looking at charter schools to be working with community media centers to increase the amount of creative skills that are given to their school-age population. So they actually see this as a competitive advantage. is the case in New Mexico, for example, if they're looking at charter school formation with community media centers, having the state involved that way. I don't know if that's something that we put within, if that's a tweak within 238 or what, but that's actually a different vision than what many of these bills describe.
Al, Representative Jenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to start the conversation going to a little difference. I'm always a glass of half full guy rather than the glass is empty and out guy. And I see some of your statements as half empty instead of half full. So I want to participate a little bit here. I'll go back to some basics. And I do think we have an opportunity for Minnesota to think outside the box and maybe not do anything that's on any of these charts that we saw. As far as PEG goes, you made the observation early on that there's seven channels in St. Paul or wherever, and they're a diverse community, and that's why, et cetera, et cetera. I would suggest that the reason there's seven channels in St. Paul and not in Wilmer is because St. Paul has X number of subscribers versus Wilmer. I mean, we have to face the fact that all this is funded, no matter what the agreement is with any city, it's funded based on the amount of people who are hooked into the system. We pay it. We're paying PEG. They're not paying it. We're paying it. We're negotiating with how much of their piece of a profit pie to bring into PEG, but basically we're paying for their profit as well as PEG as well as everything else. So I think we have to go from that basic premise first. And I guess I think if we're talking that competition is good, as the chair said, and with more competition and a better network across the states on cable franchising, if all this works, then we should see more subscribers. We should see an increase. If the model, business model works, the competition's good, more of us will sign up that don't have it now, or will sign up for a higher level of service. But somehow we'll enhance what we have. So my thinking is if there's going to be more subscribers because of this at the end, then why wouldn't there be more money for PEG? And why couldn't we do more things? Because, again, it's based on the number of subscribers. So, I'll use Charter because they're sitting next to me. But if Wilmer Charter now has Wilmer, Pennock, Spicer, I mean, if we add up their towns' populations, we have, 20,000, 25,000 people that are accessing Charter in my county. But Charter is all over the state, and they're going to add to that, and there's no reason that they have to just, if they're in St. Paul, just be focused on St. Paul PEG. They can use St. Paul, just like we do with schools in this state, just like we do with everything that's across the state, we try and equalize a little bit. And again, I'll use Charter because I'm familiar with them. For example, right now in Wilmer, and you talked about the enhanced studio capabilities, maybe a regional, I don't know if you said it or you said it, they kind of have that now. I mean, if you want to do a commercial ad or production, if you can't do it in Wilmer, I'll guarantee if you want to do a commercial ad on Charter, they'll figure out they have a state-of-the-art studio and they have technicians that will help you write the commercial, film the commercial, and distribute the commercial over the Charter cable. So they already have that, most of these companies, I suspect, in place. They have the capabilities to produce. They have people to help. So again, I guess I'd like to go back to the point that basically that PEG should still be, I think, from where I sit, there should be a certain fee per subscriber. And then as we look across the landscape, where are we at today with that pot of money? And then as the subscribers grow across the state, we should only have more opportunities for PEG. And again, it will enhance small communities because Wilmer is extremely diverse. Maybe as diverse as St. Paul, but we only have three channels available in Wilmer at this time, I think. And obviously the programming is limited because we don't have the staff because we have a limited amount of subscribers. So, again, we can use the St. Paul resources to bring programming to Wilmer, and we can add channels in Wilmer, or we can, because we're going to have more resources available. So I guess I look at it as glass half full. I don't think anyone should be looking at a reduced service, but rather I think we'll only see enhancements if we do it right and if we're charging per subscriber or that basis in the state is the way I look at it.
Thank you,
Representative Junkie. I guess the thing that's curious about this is you'd make a great cable franchise administrator, because I think that's actually the philosophy that a lot of local communities take, specifically as they look at competition. And this is true for the communities in Minnesota that have got overbuilders right now, competitors providing competitive service, but also in other states around the country. Verizon, for example, has actually done that type of competitive franchising, and they're willing to support the community benefit that's described in the original franchise, typically at that per subscriber cost. So what you're describing, I think, is true in a lot of mostly eastern communities where you've got that competition happening with a cable provider and Verizon as they take on local franchising. I think that's true. And I think your point about having the local system be able to meet those changing needs is extremely important, because 15 years ago, I don't know when the Wilmer franchise was negotiated originally, I would venture to say that the language needs alone probably weren't contemplated in that community. And trying to meet those types of language needs and educational needs is going to be, I think, the challenge that we step up to. It's a great opportunity.
I closed about 5 years ago, Mike. And okay. There's also a competitor in Wilmer, an overbuilder, that we used to be partially owned by the city, but it's no longer.
Yeah.
And Brian negotiated that franchise, and all of these issues were addressed, including peg support and funding and, studio locations.
So in that instance, can you give like a concrete example of what that means?
Is that got negotiated out?
I'm not certain what you mean. Regarding
tech. Does more support for the community occur as a result of that?
It's community involvement. It depends on the community. There's communities like Jeff, which do not have any per subscriber fee, but commit a vast, a large portion of the franchise fees to public access operations. And again, for public access fees, that has to be used specifically for capital purposes, because right now the FCC limits the franchise fee at 5%. So any city that's at 5% right now in franchise fees is going to have to request from the subscribers in the community an additional support, capital support, to buy equipment and rent buildings. And then, again, that's to the level that the city wants to commit to it. So what you've seen in the most recent franchises in the last 5 years, as city budgets have become tighter and tighter, they're pulling more to the franchise fees. For instance, in Duluth, they're pulling more away from the franchise fees, giving less of a commitment to PEG, putting that money from the franchise fees into the operation of the city, and then asking for additional revenues, which they can ask for, but it's mutually agreed upon between the city and the cable company. And again, the cable company has to take into any competitive consideration in mind, because again, 30% of the customers out there are choosing to forego in PEG channels at all and select the satellite provider.
Mark? If you'll just bear with me for a minute, I'll get to my main point, but I have to sort of walk through a number of assumptions. And what I've heard today is that 238 works today. And in the example of St. Paul, that means there are 7 PEG channels in St. Paul. And I think everybody would agree that the PEG channels are a public good, something that we would want to make sure doesn't go away. I'm not real close to the industry, but as far as I know, the current PEG channels are provided or supported by one cable TV provider. If we want a second provider in St. Paul, the first thing the incumbent cable provider says is the new guy coming in has to have the same obligations I do, so that we're on an equal competitive footing. But as far as I know, St. Paul doesn't need 14 PEG channels. So maybe at that point would be that if PEG is defined as a public good, you have to talk about how can the incumbent cable provider and the new entrant have reasonable funding to support whatever the legislature would determine would be the appropriate level of PEG as a public good. But just saying that 238 works today, it doesn't work if you would have the new incumbent provide seven more channels to St. Paul.
No, Jeff, you can speak as a cable administrator, actually.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And, you know, it's not necessarily providing an additional seven channels. What it is the subscriber is subscribing to one service or the other. And the situation would be to allow those seven channels, just seven, to be broadcast on both, so that any subscriber would have those seven channels. So it's not an additional seven channels. It is seven channels of capacity on Juanita's network. It is seven channels of capacity on Emmett's network. It is seven channels of capacity on, you know, Tucker's network. But the bottom line is it's only seven channels. So we wouldn't be asking for anything above and beyond those seven, I guess is the point. The other thing, too, that you bring up a good point in the sense that, you know, there has been some confrontation on this issue in arenas around the state already. Up in Bemidji, Tucker knows well that, you know, the Paul Bunyan Phone Company came in and they wanted to, you know, do something in the council chambers, and there was some negotiation and it didn't pan out. So there was additional cameras put in for Paul Bunyan and cameras that were, you know, Charters. And so that wasn't a good resolution, you know, in a sense, but it did serve the public good in the essence that everybody got the government, you know, city council meetings and things like that. But you bring up a good point. I mean, there has to be some negotiation to make, you know, everything flow properly. And so, you know, what value do you put on an INET? Do we need a second INET? No, we don't need a second INET, basically, in most cases. But, you know, and how do you compensate, you know, whoever put that in, whoever paid the installation fee for that, and, you know, do you split it down the middle, how do you depreciate it, you know, all those kind of things. So,
and I think that the specific challenge is that, you know, each community is going to be extremely different in terms of the what those community benefits currently look like. And I think, so, you know, whether it be the interconnection that occurs between schools, for example, in many communities, the educational channel actually is interconnected with the school itself to be able to do distance learning and that type of school support, you know, that type of work. But that's not the case in every community. And I think that's kind of the challenge here in terms of trying to figure out, you know, if you're trying to come up with a state solution as opposed to having the state talk about the contours of agreement and then having the specifics determined at the local level.
Mark, if you just carry this a little bit farther, what if there was a bill that said we'll have statewide franchises and every franchise must have certain minimum PEG requirement, it could even be, and it shall be no lower than today's PEG requirement, but that the new entrant and the company must negotiate with the city to make adjustments about how the PEG channels are going to be handled when a new entrant comes to your town.
That's how it currently exists.
That's current state law.
Yeah. I mean, there's minimum requirements that are in Chapter 238. Actually, Minnesota does have something that allows the cities to claim more channels as more programming is developed. They can come to us and make the case that, you know, they're in need of another channel, and then we'd have to provide that to them within 90 days. So, and then any new entrant also, I mean, because of the level playing field that exists, has to meet the obligations. Now, again, to Mark's earlier point about 14 channels, the cable company may operate a peg channel or a government access channel. So we're currently the provider putting that service together. But really, as each year goes by, more and more, you've got people like Jeff and Mike that are taking over operations and creating more programming, because we're in the business of providing internet, telephone, and, you know, cable service and not public access programs. And we've turned it over to either a local entity which we control or a local entity which the city controls. And that's where you'll get more and more programming channels. The issue within the level playing field is that the new entrant makes the same channel space available to, you know, to the city that the current provider is making available, so that that all of the people that are subscribing to landline services can have access to that programming. It's all equal. If there is a negotiation, you know, like with that occurred within Wilmer, with the RAC 8 facility down there, you know, it's all negotiated between all three parties at the time. The situation that Jeff alluded to in Bemidji was one of the new entrants unwilling to acknowledge any kind of contribution, less than $10,000, I should say. And so instead, they decided to create this duplicitous process. So, both sides, the competitors, can also be fairly unreasonable in just trying to acknowledge any kind of prior commitment or prior investment that's been made by the incumbent.
If I can just for a moment step back.
Can we check up, Randy, do you have a point? Yes, I have your hand.
Well, I was just going to follow up on what Representative Junkie was talking about.
Use your microphone so people can hear.
With the smaller communities, we got, 340, 350 towns under 5,000 here in Minnesota. You may have 1,500 subscribers total if there's a competitor with the two systems that are in there. And the dollars just aren't there, whether the taxpayer dollars or subscriber dollars, to have 5, 6, 7, 8 networks. It just won't work that way. So I'm not sure that a one size will fit all here in Minnesota with so many small towns that we have.
Yeah. Typically, in that kind of context, the way I understand it is that, in some cases, voluntary associations take care of the work. You know, so like they do in many small towns across Minnesota. And it's one channel, the community right. channel, as opposed, and in that instance, there's a mixture of public, educational, and governmental programming all together.
Right, yeah.
Right? And I think that's quite common across the country as well with smaller communities. And I think that's what you're describing is a particular challenge, much more so than the challenge that's in an urban environment, because I would argue that there's more need in a smaller community in some respects, certainly to reflect local culture. When was the last time you saw a network television program that came from Cloquet?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, so, you know, just the entire idea of the power of people being able to see themselves on television, see people like them on television, is an extremely powerful thing. And I think for Minnesotans and smaller communities, I hear this from communities across the country, actually, it's extremely important for them to have, to find out about their local government, their local culture, all the things that make their life distinctive. It's extremely important. And I think that's probably a greater need in some respects. And I don't know how to get at that necessarily, but I hear that a lot from small.
Well, maybe we need some sharing, and a lot of the revenues from the big cities could be sent down to the small towns so we could have more pig channels.
I used to argue for more pie.
That's not going
to
happen.
More pie for everyone as opposed to the same pie.
Someone over here on the speak. Go ahead, Joanne.
Mike, could I ask some clarifying questions going back to what you said initially? Although that is an interesting premise, it had been my assumption when we talked about PEG and PEG fees that it would still be paid to the local entity, to the municipality, not to the state, and then redirected out. But that's the concept that perhaps, you might want to look at in order to increase the greater good, et cetera, and so on, and spread the wealth to the smaller cities, and that's outside the box, definitely. But other than that, I don't think, I don't see any insurmountable problem here regarding the number of the panels or the size of the municipality. I know that a lot of the existing language talks about up to 2 channels for under 50,000, up to 3 for over 50,000, or whatever the incumbent is providing now. So that would seem to be an opening where either it could be hardwired into the language that large metropolitan areas were entitled up to 7 channels, etc., and so on. If there's language that's going to come from the growth and the change and the need for more channels, as Tucker referred to, then I think if you balance that out with if you don't use a channel, the provider can reclaim it, and you have that sort of give and take there, I think that might be acceptable too. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things when you talked about what was important, Peg. When you said channel quality, you're talking about the quality of the transmission, right? Because the production quality is pretty much up to you, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yes and no. I think there's a pretty... the quality is often dependent upon the amount of capital that's available to the local community as well. If you only have the ability to buy itty-bitty little consumer-grade cameras, and you don't have the ability to use professional grade equipment for production, you only do as well as the tools that you're given. And so I think that's a challenge for many communities. What I was specifically talking about, though, is the bandwidth for transmission to the consumer. Meaning that if I tune into ESPN, I expect ESPN to look like ESPN. Okay, I then turn over to SPNN in St. Paul. It looks like it looks similar in quality to ESPN. Okay, I think that's going to be a significant challenge as we look at changing technical standards for television over the course of the next 10 years. As HD continues to roll out, I think the expectation of consumers is going to be for greater technical quality. And even if you think about the size of the screen, whether it be someone keeps just handing these things out, the size of the screen looks very, very different. If you take an iPod video and you blow it up, it looks awful,
mm-hmm.
right? So you need to make sure that there's appropriate amount of bandwidth available so that there's a commensurate quality that the educational channels have with the commercial channels. And that also means, and just to kind of dig in a little bit deeper too, that also means the way in which you navigate them is the same. I think there's an important argument that you actually have to find the channels. Rather than say they exist somewhere, and you've got to go through a whole host of menus, and it takes you 5 minutes to go through the menus to find something that's off in a corner somewhere, you have to have the same type of navigation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also a compelling value to say that if we're on a cable system, and this is actually what many franchises currently say, if I'm on channel 19 on Comcast, I'm on channel 19 on Quest. And that specifically it gets to this question of equal treatment.
If I can just add, a lot of how the channel is marketed on the channel itself makes reference to the channel number. So if like what's happening in some communities, the peg channels on the competitive provider are being moved up into the 900 range. Now all of a sudden you've caused the whole, it's not a duplicate now. It's a whole, we have to rebrand the whole channel because it's, I mean, from our standpoint, we're not going to be putting together two master control areas, you know, as Mark indicated. You know, it's all coming from the same head end and being broadcast out to now to two providers. So for us to, you know, have channel 16 and channel 995, I mean, you know, causes a whole different problem. So
I know, and we discussed that at length the last time we tried to negotiate a bill here, and we understand your position. I know that there are perhaps one or two providers, competitive providers, that will have an issue with that. There are others that won't have an issue with that, and so it's definitely something that the chair and his group will have to address. I didn't hear you say anything directly to financial support. And so I need to know, regarding PEG, would it be your position that there needs to be a PEG support fee in addition to franchise fee in the bill or not?
The position of my national organization is that communities should not be harmed by legislation, that any type of legislation that is put forward.
So if there is a fee,
it should be maintained. And that's actually what we would be advocating with any type of local franchise negotiation, that the fee be maintained.
Okay.
And I think that it gets back to the specific issue here, is that my organization wants to ensure there's not a race to the bottom with community benefits.
Okay.
So
I understand that. And another thing, too, and then I'm done, I promise. I'm sensing sort of a business opportunity here for, like, the city of St. Paul regarding being able to distribute programming that is suitable for PEG channels across the state into towns that actually don't have that content themselves, and or doing production for other cities and or training folks. Would we need something in legislation that would allow you to do that, and would any cable administrators and PEG directors in the state be interested in doing that? That's an outside the box. You may want to think about that.
Yeah, that one's kind of hard for me to, and I'm not the city of St. Paul, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, none of my remarks are that it either.
some of this stuff might be things to think about, you don't need to answer it right.
I mean, I guess to get back to the Representative Junkie's key point is that, you know, if community needs change, there's got to be ways for corporations and local communities and members of the public to step up to meet those challenges. And, I'm in thorough agreement with that principle. You know.
And just follow up, Mike, I would encourage you, instead of the think, do no harm paradigm that you have, think in terms of what can you do to make things better. Jeff?
Before we leave Representative Junkie's comments, I must admit that, at least stepping outside of my MACTA hat for a second and thinking about the city of Lakeville, although the idea is very intriguing, I know my subscribers who do not pay any kind of PEG fee right now would be vehemently opposed to adding a $3 PEG fee to pay for outstate cities to have PEG. You know, I mean, I don't mind.
How is PEG paid for? Right?
We don't have PEG. We don't have a PEG fee.
They've chosen not to have it.
So you have a fee, though.
We just have a franchise fee.
But that's, Mr. Chair, that's the same thing.
No, there's two different fees. The franchise fee and PEG fee.
But the fees are based on per cable subscriber. You can negotiate a certain amount. My point is, you can negotiate a certain amount in Lakeville because of your number of subscribers.
Not above the 5% franchise. We've chosen to live with our government access productions under the 5% franchise fee. That's it. And that's an individual right that we have as a city to negotate that franchise that way.
But the subscribers are paying that. That's my point.
Well, yeah. And
ultimately, the subscribers pay that. So do no harm or, you know, do better than, that's the minimum. You still have that dollar amount available.
No, I understand that. But the PEG fee, then, is in addition to the 5%. The city of Roseville, for example, they've chosen to pay $2.65 above and beyond the 5% franchise fee, And those people pay for that service. They have a large staff and trucks and the studio and everything like that. Our folks have not allowed, not elected to do that. They haven't gone down that road. And that's, I believe that's their right. So, you know, although it's an interesting idea, and I wouldn't mind, you know, if you want to study it or, you know, look at it further, but the bottom line for us is our people are complaining about the rates as they are right now. And they don't have a peg fee. And then if you're going to say, you know, if we're going to throw a peg fee on, and then it's going to go outside, I mean, you know, that would be difficult. It would be difficult to sell.
Emmett, you had that finger up there for a minute.
One on each hand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Emmett Coleman with Comcast. I'm curious, I guess, in listening to Mike and Jeff and others talk, one of the things that Mike suggested very early on, and I think he's kind of circled back to it a couple times, but is this concept that things are being done at the local level currently, that the local level has the flexibility within the current system to adjust to those changes, to adjust to new dynamics, to adjust to new competitive entrants, and that they have that flexibility now, that he has a national organization that has essentially proclaimed first do no harm. And there's a couple of questions that kind of stem from that. The first one is to Mike and to Jeff would be, is there any scenario under which you create a statewide system where you can envision maintaining that local flexibility? And I don't see it. And I think Mike even stated that there's no example of where it's been done around the country where that has actually happened, where, in fact, things, the local flexibility and some of that local creativity has been maintained. And so at first I'd ask you if that's the case. Would you care to comment on that perspective?
You know, the only state bill that has significant safety provisions in it is, that's, you know, from the Atlantic Community Media's perspective, is Illinois. And how that's enacted is unclear. That was only passed 5 months ago. So, totally unclear.
Is it better than what you currently have in Minnesota?
No. I think there's a different. I mean, I think the other thing that people should understand is it's not as if public access organizations, school district, you know, people within the, you know, the PEG community are always working within lockstep with municipalities too. And I think that's the other thing you've got to be realizing here as we're having this conversation. You know, I think there are many smaller communities across the state of Minnesota that I heard from during the federal discussion in 2005-2006 that said that they would have benefited from the federal bill that was being discussed. But that was peg providers saying that, not local cities. So very often there's a political struggle that can happen between a municipality and public access organization. Okay, and I guess there's sort of a question here as to whether or not that's part of the beauty of the system or the ugliness of the system that exists right now. For FPNN, for my organization in St. Paul, if I were to wave a magic wand and say, state law will give us support for the rest of our days, it would be a beautiful thing, but, you know, there's lots of things I can wave my magic wand for. It's probably not a political reality. So I think there's sort of this balance that we've got to be dealing with here between municipal interests, public interests, which sometimes are not always in lockstep with municipal interests, and corporate interests, as they're trying to provide programming to consumers. And actually, I think that's the thing that's kind of interesting about the system right now in Minnesota, is it balances all those three things out. So I think that's the challenge that people need to be thinking about, is they're thinking about this.
Well, it sounds like in addition to a challenge, it's equally, if not greater, a risk.
Right.
It's that the balance exists under the current law, and if you attempt to change that law and to play with it, that the risk increases dramatically, that the balance gets thrown off dramatically.
Well, yeah. I guess there's another way to look at this, too, and I don't want to dominate the discussion. Another way to look at this is that with increasing financial pressure upon municipalities, that's happening across the state of Minnesota, they're forced increasingly to look at providing public access services on television and providing for fire departments, police service, things like that. There's an increasing financial pressure on cities. So I know that there's going to be a continuing political struggle that occurs on the local level as cities are trying to figure out how to pay for these services that they're in right now. I think we don't want to have a position where the state is putting more pressure on cities, because then you'd actually be seeing a reduction in public access services. Okay? So I think that's just as big a risk.
Randy, you were encouraging us to think outside of the box, correct? Mundo, for fear of being charged with heresy and maybe burnt at the stake, let me attempt something. If in markets where we do have competitors, more than one provider, not counting the satellite, maybe we ought to look at, rather than increasing, why don't we decrease the number of paid channels that are required, and then let the competitive marketplace add channels. If there is, in fact, a value that the subscriber sees in paid channels, then the competitors will be adding paid channels, and it won't be a rush to the bottom, because each will be trying to outdo the other and having better paid programming. And you'll end up with more paid channels rather than fewer, and you won't have the struggle between the city wanting to take the money to use for the general fund and the cable administrators wanting to spend that on more paid programs.
So do you want to get tied to the stake right now, or?
can you restate that in the form of a sentence? I'm trying to wrap my head around what you said.
Where there is competition, reduce the number of required paid channels that both competitors would provide, and let the marketplace add additional channels. So if I want a competitive advantage over my competitor, and in fact the customers want more paid channels, I'll put in paid channels, I'll be doing it myself, and I'll do better programming than the other guy is doing if he puts in, because we don't have to share that pig channel. It's what I'm doing in the marketplace so that I have a better product than my customer, than my competitor does, because beyond a better pig channel, we've all got the same network lineups that we're providing.
There's a compelling reason why you'd want to have one government channel.
I'm not arguing
right.
Eliminate them, but have
right.
a couple, but cut them back and then let the marketplace decide how much they're ought to be.
You know, in certain markets, in certain conditions, markets actually fail. So, you know, to give you a good example, in terms of community programming on peg channels that would be jeopardized in that kind of scenario. You know, there are 10 regularly produced Somali programs in Minneapolis, and you know, the refugee population really isn't yet at the point where it can substantially maintain commercial business for broadcast.
And if I had 5 or 10, 15% of my population in West Overshoe, Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to make sure I had all of their cable business, I'd put a Somali channel on.
Yeah, but you still have the same amount of nonprofit staff or government staff that is producing the programming.
I do it as a provider.
Well, that's not what you're saying. You're saying eliminate or reduce the number of channels that the incumbent provider is offering, in hopes that the competitive provider will up the programming. And that they don't produce the programming. They don't want to. You just heard Tucker say a minute ago that they don't want public access. They want it out of the system.
Oh, but they would want.
They want us to have it.
They would want to if in fact the public saw a good in one of those channels, and I was offering better channels than Tucker was. I'd have an advantage, and I'd be getting more subscribers. So I'd want to put on good public. It's happening up in Melrose now,
mm-hmm.
where the telephone company has no obligation, and they're putting on a very good public access channel, doing lots of their own programming and doing it on their own time, rather than having a squabble with the city as to is this money paid going into the city general fund or going for channels. So let the marketplace do it.
Well, and I guess just to get to that point, it's actually quite common for new entrants to do that anyway, where they'll make investments in local origination programs. And they're not prevented from doing that now. If you eliminate the public benefit, I don't know that you'd necessarily see market entry in that instance, but it's a curious notion.
So I'm not... I just had a question. I'm just wondering, do folks have numbers on viewership from public access and peg channels?
Yeah,
what?
So I think Channel 12 has done TV.
I mean, I could speak to this instance in St. Paul. The problem is that most of the educational channels within the Twin Cities market aren't encompassed within the Nielsen rating system. For smaller community operations, the data it doesn't exist typically because the community would actually have to do some sort of ascertainment survey. We did a survey with Wilder Foundation several years ago to find out how many St. Paul cable viewers watch our channel. And we've got five channels, so the odds of you watching our programming are greater than if you're in a community with one channel. 60% of viewers say they watch our channels in St. Paul. Now, that's actually a pretty good saturation. But also, we produce original programming about public affairs, community events within St. Paul. We're a pretty well-known entity. So it'll vary from community to community. I think Northwest Community Television in Brooklyn Park, Plymouth, does a very good job of reaching viewers. I don't know if Greg Moore has specific data on that, but anecdotally, they hear from community businesses that if they want to do non-commercial advertising, they do it with Northwest Community Television rather with the local television market because they get that much saturation. I don't know if Greg, if you could speak to that or not.
Yeah, we do a Greg Moore and we get annual surveys for about 15 years now where you spread them out a little bit more, but essentially the numbers indicate that about 60% of subscribers watch community channels, 20-25% watch on a different basis. And when we compare them with the cable lineup generally, we end up about mid-10. We don't have the leadership of an ESPN or a CNN, but way up at the bottom. We also asked a question about perceived value. We asked how much you would pay for these channels. And again, although our leadership is ESPN or CNN, the dollar value that subscribers place on community television is as high or greater than ESPN. So we've done these surveys for a professional polling service either. We've done over 20 years and we're close.
All right. Well, thank you for that information.
Go ahead. I was going to say, Randy, I think your theory is nice, but I think economic realities are not going to bear that out. I think from what I've gathered in Indiana, for instance, they eliminated PEG mandatory make, and Comcast immediately pulled their PEG support.
can be answered.
Do they have competition?
Statewide franchise, but it wasn't, yeah, they didn't have any.
I can understand where there's no competition. You pull the big channel, the provider is going to quit doing it. Well, they'll still put ads, but if you got a competitor there, and in fact, if the public sees that as an advantage, the public doesn't see it as an advantage, then why are you offering so many big channels that they don't think it's a benefit?
I think we're kind of winding down here in terms of issues, and Juanita, do you have something?
I'd just like to offer from a new entrance perspective when we think about tech, that any legislation should really ensure that the various technologies and the way those technologies operate are not precluded under the legislation. Because IPTV, for example, operates technologically very different than your, standard or your the cable that is provided today. And so, you know, when Mike was talking about making sure, you know, channel location, navigation, those things are issues with the new technologies. But it's the way that technology is developed, and we need to ensure that the legislature wouldn't preclude that. And I'll give you an example of that. Where we have rolled out our IPTV, how we handle PEG support is nationwide, whether you're in California or you are in Texas or you're in Minnesota, we offered it here, it would be on channel 99. And what happens is all seven channels in the metropolitan area or all 150 in Los Angeles are on channel 99. And then the subscriber actually, you know, they would go to channel 99 and then there's a drop-down menu. And in that drop-down menu, then the subscriber themselves have the capability of deciding, okay, what channel do I want to be in that first slot so that, you know, I don't have to scroll through 150 channels. But it isn't going to allow our technology that we have today would not allow us to put on channel 6, you know, channel 6. It's going to have to go on to channel 99. And it's because our technology, we are deploying it through our traditional telephone structure, which is very different than having it go to the head ends where the head ends can insert that. And so I guess I would just caution to make sure that as we look at legislation, if you really want competitors to come into the market, that we ensure that we don't structure it to just model what's in existence today, and that we actually allow the language to allow the different technologies to work.
And if I could speak to this, I mean, one of you raised a very interesting point about you versus capabilities and its ability to meet those needs. You know, the question I ask is sort of a fundamental one. Does a consumer have the same experience when they try to reach ESPN? They don't.
In terms of?
Trying to get into a menu to get to a program channel.
They just channel change and it goes right to the channel.
Right. So that's not a technological issue. That's a choice by the way in which the universe has been constructed by a corporation. So that, you know, if I'm a UVerse subscriber, I don't have to go through that channel menu for ESPN, menu for ESPN or CNN, do I? I don't.
No, you do not.
And that's a choice that the corporation made, okay, as it constructed the system.
No, it's really, but I think that's where the foul.
The channel mapping issue.
The channel mapping issue, yeah.
The difference in the technology and how the systems are built and the capabilities of the IPTV, it doesn't, you know, it's not structured in the same fashion. Okay, the feeds are coming in, PEG channel feeds are going to come in differently than ESPN comes in to those systems. That wasn't a choice, that's a limitation of the technology that exists today. And so what I'm saying is that if the goal of this is to bring competition, then just like in any other market that has opened up to competition, you have to allow the technology to work. And if that is a choice that the consumer, because at the end of the day, we're trying to give consumers more choices. But at the same time, we want to make those the capabilities of PEG available to all consumers. If it's important that you only get channel 6 on the remote and you get a PEG channel, then you're of course going to stay with your incumbent. But if you like to watch public access TV and you want opportunities to choose another provider, you may not care that you have to hit 99, and then all of a sudden maybe that provider offers every channel that PEG is offered in the state, because that capability exists on my system. I mean, if I wanted, it's not a problem for me to have 150 PEG stations on channel 99 instead of the 7. Maybe I carry the whole state, and that's more attractive because some consumer wants it. Or the consumer in the rural area who has no PEG opportunities wants to see the St. Paul. Well, my system would allow that rural customer to have access to that. Once we get it into our system, it's available. So I'm just, that's the point I want to make.
No, I appreciate that. And that's kind of the idea, is to get some of those ideas out. We're kind of winding down here, and if someone didn't bring up something you think that's important for the group to hear, this would be a good time to do it, because what we're going to do next is close shortly, give a brief assignment, and get back together in a month or so. But Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to address briefly Randy's comments. I think that kind of misrepresents the way the market actually works. What you're assuming, Randy, is that if there is enough demand, someone will meet it. What you're saying is that people should imagine what they would like to see in the public education or government channel and then ask for it. But that isn't the way the market works. If it did work that way, we wouldn't be inundated with all of the consumer products that we are, that we're asked to choose among. Public doesn't ask for those things. People create them in hope that they will be sufficiently attractive to a sufficient number of people that they will decide to buy it. But they don't do that on the basis of people's imagining what could be and asking for it, which is what you're saying. Doesn't work that way.
I do have one question for Juanita, if I could.
Okay.
As I understand it, the way that AT&T provides service, they have what are called wire centers, and they're not contiguous or mapped out such that they match up with municipal boundaries.
That's correct.
So if how would you provide the 3 to 7 channels then for each municipality if your wire centers don't match up with their municipal boundaries? Is it just through that channel 99? Is that it?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, how it works is let's just take the Minneapolis St. Paul area, okay? We have a video center that would serve that entire area, okay? And if there were the 7 channels, then would be fed into us, and then we would broadcast all 7 of those. But if there was if you had a community that sat right outside St. Paul, and I'm sorry that I can't think of the name of the city, but if you had one, then, and they had a PEG channel and it was on our system, we could, and there was demand there and customers wanted it, we could make that also available as part of the St. Paul Minneapolis channel 99 as well. And so you could see 8 channels or 9 channels or 20 channels in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Or if you're out in, rural Minnesota, you could see those same 8, 9, 10, 12 channels.
Okay.
Well, but the guy in the audience has been waiting quietly. Go ahead.
Well, it's just an issue that hasn't been addressed. You may understand the legislation there with the
incumbent franchises held by incumbent cable operators, and municipalities would still be in charge of those franchises. And the new competitors, the license of the franchise would be granted by the state, and the PUC would be in charge of those franchises. What happens if there's a conflict between what the cities, or the cities want to regulate the third party access operations and the state, so they want to regulate the third party access entities? Inevitably, there's going to be a conflict. You're going to have cities wanting it to operate one way, and the state wanting it to operate the other way. How do you resolve it? I mean, it's a fundamental question, I think. Unless two policy bodies are going to come up with identical answers, which would be a first, I just wonder what the process is to resolve the issue.
And that's not really a PEG question, though, is it?
Well, it is a PEG question. If I'm a third party, the city, I am ultimately responsible to the city. If there was a competitor with a license granted by the state, then I was carrying the same channels to the competitor, then essentially my boss would be the state and the city, and they could very conceivably have a conflict in terms of the way they want these channels to operate. I'm wondering what the mechanism is to resolve that.
Well, it sounds like a good question, maybe a local control issue that we need to take a look at. I don't know if anybody here wants to take a stab at it, but
to
bring it forth.
I think what he's referring to is the dual-track regulatory structure. So if you leave the, you know, leave the incumbent operating under a local control without any kind of statewide option. So it's either, you know, again, it's like with the franchise fees and the growth revenues, everything else, it's difficult when you've got to do a track regulatory structure, which is what was created in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Tom.
The local governments have been spending a lot of time today talking about what we would hope for in the perfect world, which never exists. But I'd ask somebody like Quest, Andy, how would you meet some of our needs, desires, goals that we have for the unique, meeting the unique local government needs in different jurisdictions under some sort of statewide franchise? How would Quest propose to do that?
Kind of a loaded question. I think we would just yield to whatever the state control. I mean, we would be looking for a format or a structure from the state and direction how to act or to act in jurisdiction by jurisdiction. So we'd be looking for one simple process.
As a follow-up to that, Andy, can you describe why things changed so dramatically from the first time you guys testified on the way Quest's position was to why now the group response from you and AT&T and Verizon is dramatically different?
Well, there are four parties in this, and there were four parties in the discussion, so we collectively tried to reach some sort of a central point that we could all agree on. I don't necessarily agree with everything in there. I don't think AT&T necessarily or Frontier agrees with everything in there. But what we tried to do was come up with one position that we could all work from. And if you bring your position forward, we would be happy to have discussions on how to resolve the gap between those two positions.
Well, again, we're winding down here, and I think we've got enough information out on the table to think about and give some thought to. I want to reaffirm that we're expecting position papers on PEG by January 4th of next year, your position on PEG and how you could see as meeting up the needs. I do get a sense that there's agreement that PEG's a common good that we need to make sure that it is taken care of, and I don't see any reason why we can't get to that point, and if we put on our thinking caps, we can get it done. We're going to circulate the position papers once we get them so everyone has a chance to look at them and review them. I also want to add that a thank you for everyone who's been willing to be involved in this process. You know, I think we are, it's a struggle. We are moving in a direction I think that's positive, but it does take work. It is frustrating. It is difficult. I mean, the issues are so complex, and everybody has a piece of pie that they're protecting or want to make sure it doesn't get moved one way or the other. But again, my point is that we want to put together a bill that that's good for the state, that creates more competition, that takes care of the needs of PEG, local control, that expands broadband penetration, and I think it can be done, and that's the direction we're going to go. So thank you, each one of you, for being here, and we look forward to meeting with you as we continue talking about these issues.
President Johnson, can I ask if we could, Mr. Eloff, for the next meeting in January? One of the items you discussed, and there's a lot of studies right now. I mean, Mr. Eloff had mentioned all the different state laws that are out there, and the fact that from the first time you started looking at this to now, how many more there are. Can there be the analysis, an impartial analysis, because we all have our own analyses of what these state laws have actually done to encourage competition, you know, and especially more towards, you know, what Ron's area would be concerned of, the competition, and this is going to be especially prevalent to the discussion topics the next meeting. In low-income areas, where that competition has really occurred, where the build-out has occurred, and if it's in low-income areas. Is that something we could get to the next meeting?
Oh, Bob, right. We'll talk about it. Bob, you want to give an answer?
I just want to make sure I understand what you're asking. I can certainly tell you what the laws meant as to what has resulted. Like Mike said, we have such a short, it's been such a short amount of time since those laws have been implemented, so there's not much of a track record. And the other thing I'd say is if people have information from other states on what has happened, we'd be very happy to see it.
Yeah, some of them, Texas has been around now for about 4 years, you know, and Verizon and their commitments and things like that. So I think it's a good, because it is one of the goals that you're looking for, and I think it might be some beneficial information to have into the next meeting. So
yeah, if you have information, make sure you submit. We'd love to see it. I want to recognize Representative Hoppe here. Well, how are you doing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well,
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas. Ron Schmansky, good to see you here, too. Thanks for coming. Again, thank you, everybody, for being here. Again, have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, and let's keep working.